Indiana University's Dr. George Sledge and Dr. Kathy Miller are two of my favorite interviewees in our breast cancer series, and Hoosierland has become the focal point of anti-angiogenic therapy of cancer. I met with another IU faculty person, Dr. Nasser Hanna, to learn about current clinical research efforts in lung cancer, and he began our conversation by commenting on the unique cooperative group their cancer center has spawned.
The Hoosier Oncology Group has a long history of doing clinical trials. The area we've probably been most successful in have been in the area of lung cancer research. And so recently we have conducted some clinical trials in both small cell and non-small cell lung cancer. We are involved in a performance status 2 trial. This is for also patients who are previously untreated with advanced non-small cell lung cancer, and we're going to be looking at the combination of erlotinib with bevacizumab. And the rationale of this study is really based upon the important interactions between the EGFR pathway and the VEGF pathway. And Dr. Sandler and Dr. Herbst have demonstrated that in the previously treated patients, that combination certainly looks promising. So we're hoping to move it forward into the first-line treatment for those who have performance status 2. And those patients with performance status 2 really don't have a perfectly defined standard of therapy. Some physicians believe supportive care alone is appropriate. Others believe single-agent chemotherapy. And others believe that combination chemotherapy is standard. There certainly is not an established standard. There's actually been an interesting observation that definitely needs prospective testing in lung cancer. There are these patients who are never smokers, usually, who have adenocarcinomas primarily, and they have, you know, very advanced disease. They oftentimes have 100 pulmonary nodules. And then you treat them with erlotinib, for instance, and they get these quick and dramatic responses, and they tend to be durable. And then after some period of time, their cancer starts to slowly progress. It doesn't flare. There's not this rapid progression. And the patient continues to look and feel well. They feel much better than they did initially. And then the issue is, should you stop the erlotinib and switch strategies, or should you continue the erlotinib? And some of my colleagues, and I've actually come to this as well, if you stop the erlotinib, the perception, at least, is that the cancers grow more quickly.
Interesting.
And so I think that's a hypothesis worth testing. And so what you would do is you would do a randomized trial in that subset of patients, patients who had an initial response to erlotinib. This could even be in the second line setting. And now their cancer is progressing, but by some criteria, it's progressing slowly. And you would randomize them to stopping the erlotinib and switching drugs versus continuing with the erlotinib and then figuring out what your endpoints are.
And what would the next drug be? Bevacizumab if they haven't had it?
I hadn't thought through it, but, you know, that's an interesting thought to add bevacizumab. Obviously, you could go to a cytotoxic agent.
Well, I've heard about that strategy on the non-smoker. Maybe it makes sense to start erlotinib earlier. And then again, maybe in some patients, instead of stopping it, just adding in the bev. But I don't know if that trial's ever going to get done.
I think those are important hypotheses to test. The interesting thing about the EGFR TK inhibitors is what predicts response for this class of drugs is very different than what predicts response for chemotherapy, particularly in the second and third line setting. I'll give you a couple of quick examples. Patients are much more likely to respond to chemotherapy in the early stage setting versus the metastatic setting. They're much more likely to respond as first line metastatic than they are second line metastatic, and more likely to respond second line metastatic than third line metastatic. Patients with good performance status are more likely to respond to chemotherapy compared to those who have a poor performance status. Those who responded to their initial chemotherapy are more likely to respond to subsequent chemotherapy versus those who progressed during their initial chemotherapy. All of those things don't seem to matter with the EGFR TK inhibitors. It doesn't matter if you give the drug second line, third line, fourth line, fifth line. Response rate's the same. Response rate's the same regardless of what their performance status is. Performance status 0 patients don't have higher response rates compared to performance status 3 patients. And response to prior chemotherapy doesn't matter either. Those patients who had a partial response to first-line chemotherapy are no more likely to respond to erlotinib than those patients who had progression with first-line chemotherapy. So it's an interesting distinction between this class of drugs and conventional therapy.
You mentioned the study looking at erlotinib and bevacizumab. Could you kind of summarize what your take was on the Sandler and Herb study and also talk about the randomized trial they're doing now?
It's a very important study because once patients are in the second line setting, their survival times are usually very short. The vast majority of people do not survive a year. It's really unacceptable to induce toxicities in this patient population, particularly when your goal is palliation. And so if you can come up with a regimen which is well tolerated in this group of patients and effective, then that would be ideal. And in the second line setting, you would expect with chemotherapy agents, the response rate to be about 10%. And you'd expect the median survival time to be about 6 to 8 months. And what was interesting with the erlotinib plus bevacizumab data was that the response rate was over 20% and the median survival time exceeded a year. Now, granted, that was a phase 2 study, 2-institution study, but it's still quite remarkable. We don't really have other phase 2 studies that show that good of data, particularly the survival data. So I do think it's appropriate to do a randomized phase 3 study. As you know, erlotinib is approved for second-line treatment, and so I believe the study design is erlotinib with or without bevacizumab.
And I guess also the general take from that study was it seemed to be pretty well tolerated.
Very well tolerated. Obviously, these drugs don't have the same side effect profiles as chemotherapy drugs. They don't typically cause nausea, vomiting, alopecia, diarrhea, mucositis, myelosuppression, etc.
What's your clinical experience with the combination?
I've never given erlotinib and bevacizumab in combination. I have been routinely using bevacizumab in combination with chemotherapy for my good performance first-line patients who are what we call bevacizumab eligible, and I have used erlotinib and before that gefitinib for several years now.
That's interesting. Just waiting for you to come over here today, I was checking my email and saw that the JCO had electronically published the paper from Memorial on smoking history and EGFR mutations that I guess they presented last year at ASCO. I think this whole thing with the smoking status and EGFR, it's just incredible. Can you talk a little bit about what your take is on that whole thing?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've always believed, or at least thought, that the biology of lung cancer would seem to be different in that the never smoker versus the person who has smoked. And just an easy example of that is KRAS mutations, which are not uncommon in smokers, particularly those who have adenocarcinoma. KRAS mutations are almost never seen in a never smoker who develops lung cancer. And never smokers rarely get tumors like squamous cell or large cell or small cell cancer. They almost always get adenocarcinoma or bronchoalveolar carcinoma. So clearly there appeared to be something unique about this. And it really shouldn't surprise us that those patients who've never smoked seem to disproportionately benefit from EGFR inhibitors.
What's your take right now in terms of whether you think that any of this is sort of ready for clinical application? If you see a patient in a non-protocol setting who, for whatever reason, has had one of these mutation tests on or EGFR or FISH, will you pay attention to it?
It's hard to know because some patients who have EGFR mutations don't respond to the EGFR inhibitors. So it's not a perfect, in fact, when the data first came out, it appeared to be about 80 to 90% predictive of response. It now appears to be more along the lines of 30 to 40% predictive. Some data have suggested that EGFR mutations don't predict for survival outcomes. Other data suggest that patients who have the mutations tend to do better, no matter if they're treated with chemotherapy or if they're treated with the EGFR inhibitors. Recent data suggested that if you do FISH analysis looking at gene copy number, that that is also a predictor of response, but it seems to be a predictor of response on the order of 20 to 30%. And it does seem to be a little bit better predictor of survival in that group of patients. Interestingly, the clinical parameter of never smoking seems to be the most powerful indicator for response to this class of drugs. And also the clinical indicator of performance status still is the most important factor to determine survival for patients. And those are not things that are done on the tumor. They're not blood tests. They're just clinical parameters.
I think this is one of the most fascinating things going on cancer medicine right now. I'd like to pursue it a little bit more. If a patient with non-small cell who's a non-smoker in a good condition, first-line metastatic setting, says to you, what's your best guess of the response rate I'll have to a TK inhibitor or erlotinib? How would you answer it?
That's very hard to know. I would say that they are more likely than the person who has smoked to respond to therapy. The question is, are they also more likely to respond to chemotherapy? Are they more likely to do better just because of the biology of their disease, and perhaps treating them with an EGFR TK inhibitor at some point is reasonable and not necessarily upfront? We really haven't worked out the best way to do things. It may very well be that the optimal survival for that patient perhaps would be to give them chemotherapy upfront, followed by an EGFR inhibitor at the time of progression, versus the other way around. That would be one hypothesis, for instance. I would like to highlight a couple of important clinical trials within the Hoosier Oncology Group. My colleague at Indiana University, Kathy Miller, presented important data in breast cancer, looking at patients with metastatic disease who'd previously been treated, and they were randomized to getting either paclitaxel alone or paclitaxel with bevacizumab. And her data, reported at ASCO last year, indicated that the response rates were higher and the time to disease progression were significantly longer with that combination. Survival data is not yet mature, but it looks promising at this point. So we've taken that look and we have decided to try to apply this to small cell lung cancer. And so within the Hoosier Oncology Group, we're actually using Kathy's regimen with weekly paclitaxel combined with every other week bevacizumab, and it's given at 10 milligrams per kilogram as she had given it on her protocol. And the idea here is that angiogenesis is very important in small cell lung cancer, that those patients who have high VEGF levels have a worse prognosis compared to those patients with low VEGF levels, and that the combination obviously looked very exciting, particularly when you combine angiogenesis inhibitors with low-dose taxanes, which are also believed to have anti-angiogenic properties as well. So we are conducting that phase 2 study in the Hoosier Oncology Group, and my hope would be to push that forward and to push angiogenesis forward within small cell lung cancer research.
What was your thinking in choosing to look at paclitaxel as opposed to nab-paclitaxel?
No great reason for that other than Kathy's regimen appeared very promising. And paclitaxel has been studied in small cell lung cancer. It's certainly an active agent. In fact, it's the reason why two large randomized trials were done with paclitaxel combined with EP, one in Greece and one in the CALGB. Unfortunately, those three drug regimens were no better than the two drug regimens. But having said that, it does have its unique single agent activity. And we do have the safety data from Kathy's study and the promise that this is a effective regimen. So that's why we did choose that regimen.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess I'm curious, though, because, you know, well, NAB has been approved now in breast cancer for about a year, and people are sort of trying to figure that out. But there do seem to be clear-cut advantages. You just wonder about it in lung cancer. Do you see that being studied soon?
I would think it's likely to be studied soon.
Be interesting to see whether or not, for example, pre-medications, how much of an issue that is in lung cancer. Do you think it's maybe more of an issue in terms of comorbidities and other problems than, say, breast cancer?
It very well may be. As you know, the patient populations are vastly different, and our patients tend to have a lot of comorbidities. They tend to have diabetes, they tend to be on cardiac medications, and they have COPD, and so it is a very different group of patients. And this is one of the reasons why it is really imperative to look at regimens that are better tolerated.
What else is going on in the group?
The other important study that I think we are near completing is our randomized phase 3 study in stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer. The Southwest Oncology Group reported a phase 2 study. This was SWOG 9504. This has since been published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology by Dr. Gandera, and this was an 83-patient study. They looked at good performance status patients who had stage 3B disease only. And in this group of patients, the historical control for median survival would be about 12 to 13 months, and the historical control for 5-year survival would be about 3%. Well, in the phase 2 study, they did report a median survival time of 26 months, doubling against the historical control, and an astonishing 5-year survival of 29%, which is really 6 to 8-fold higher than what you would expect.
That was updated last year at ASCO.
That was updated. The 5-year analysis was updated, and that's where we come up with the 29% figure, including a 20% 5-year survival for patients with N3 disease. And that is truly quite good, at least compared to historical controls. Now, the Southwest Oncology Group did a follow-up study, and they did report that at ASCO last year. That was SWOG 0023. And this was a randomized trial in which patients with both 3A and 3B disease, good performance status, good pulmonary function, their FEV1 had to be greater than 2 liters, or the expected FEV1 in the unaffected contralateral lung had to be greater than 800 cc's. So in general, in our patient population, it's actually a reasonably good pulmonary function. And these patients all received the SWOG 9504 regimen. They received cisplatin plus etoposide concurrently with radiation, and then they went on to receive 3 cycles of docetaxel. If they were able to complete all of that therapy without undue toxicities, progression of disease, or death, then they were randomized to receive either placebo or gefitinib. The study was reported earlier than they had expected because there was some concern about gefitinib and the issues with the negative ISIL study showing it had not statistically prolonged survival compared to placebo. So there was an unplanned analysis to look to make sure that they were doing okay, and the statisticians came to the opinion that there was no way that if the trial continued that gefitinib would be better than placebo. So we learned quite a few things from that trial. The first thing that we learned was that the median survival time for all 575 entered and eligible patients was 19 months, which was a bit less than the 26 months that one might expect, or that one was hopeful of in the phase 2 data. Secondly, we did learn that it was much more difficult to get patients through the consolidation therapy than had been expected. The trial design called for 80% of the patients who entered to be randomized. Turned out that only 44% of the patients who were entered were actually randomized. So in other words, getting through induction and getting through 3 cycles of docetaxel. They didn't get randomized until they were through docetaxel consolidation.
Oh, to the gefitinib plus or minus gefitinib.
Exactly.
Okay, right. So let's sort of dissect out a couple of the things that you've talked about. First, I'm just kind of curious. Some people have looked at those data and said, it looks like gefitinib had a negative impact. And others have said, it's just statistical noise, there's not enough events.
Boy, I tell you, the curves split widely. And it is very possible that this is all due to chance. And certainly if the curves had been reversed, we would have been very excited and may not have met statistical significance, but we would have said there was a strong trend. And I could imagine that being very compelling evidence for many physicians. What's very interesting about that data is if you look carefully at the progression-free survival curves, they actually overlap until about 1 year, and then they begin to split. And that's about the time where you would expect patients to be getting their gefitinib and having been on it for a few months. So it's an interesting split in the curves.
I guess the other issue with these data is the baseline chemo radiation maintenance regimen, which of course is the issue with your trial. And to me, it seems like maybe these data suggested maybe some caution in terms of selecting patients who are going to receive the therapy. But I don't know that it says that people who are able to receive it won't have the same kind of benefit that had been seen previously with 9504.
That's right.
Is that your take?
I agree with that. And I think what we have to say about the 0023 data is that it does not, in my opinion, confirm the favorable survival of 9504. It does not refute it either. It neither confirms nor refutes it. And what we do need is a randomized trial looking at the question in particular. And so the Hoosier Oncology Group for the last 3.5 years, in a collaboration with U.S. Oncology as well, have been conducting a randomized trial in which patients with stage 3A, 3B disease who have a performance status of 0 or 1, who have lost less than 5 kilograms of weight in the preceding 3 months, and who don't have any contraindications to therapy, they're all considered unresectable. They're all treated with cisplatin plus VP16 with chest radiation, just as the SWOG has done for years now. And then after completion of that therapy, as long as they haven't progressed, as long as they haven't had undue toxicity, and as long as they maintain a performance status of 0, 1, or 2 at the time of randomization, then they're randomized to either be observed or to receive 3 cycles of docetaxel. At ASCO this year, one of my talented fellows will be presenting some initial data regarding consolidation therapy. And the issues at hand are, in our patient population, what percentage of patients were able to be randomized? What percentage who received docetaxel received all 3 cycles of docetaxel? what percentage needed dose reductions or dose omissions, what percentage required growth factor support, what were the complication rates of patients, including hospitalization rates, blood transfusion rates, and such. I think these are all very important things to consider. Now, one major difference between our trial and the Southwest Oncology Group trial is that the pulmonary function of patients only had to be an FEV1 of greater than 1 liter. And I really do think that that represents the smoking lung cancer population to a greater degree than an FEV1 of greater than 2 liters. In fact, we looked at our data, and based upon that criteria alone, half of the patients who entered our trial would not have been eligible for the Southwest Oncology Group trial. And I do think that patients who have better pulmonary function probably do have better cardiac function, probably are more fit patients. And it's also important when viewing rates of pneumonitis and late complications of therapy that we really understand what the baseline pulmonary function of patients is. If somebody's baseline pulmonary function is excellent, they can take some pneumonitis and some pulmonary fibrosis. But if your FEV1 starts off pretty borderline and you start causing fibrosis, that patient's likely to remain on oxygen and be chronically short of breath, which is very unpleasant for patients. So I do think with that criteria, our trial will actually represent a more representative group of patients in the general community.
The issue of neutropenic fever ties in a sense to the issue of the NCCN guidelines as it relates to preventive growth factors. They've kind of come up with this system right now saying 20% treat, 10 to 20 with comorbidities treat, which is a lot of lung cancer patients. Where do you think the 75 per meter squared of docetaxel fits in specifically there in general? And what about other regimens in lung cancer?
I agree with those guidelines, particularly with the issue of comorbidities. That clearly is a major risk factor, age of patients, comorbidities, those types of things. I think if you are going to use consolidation docetaxel, you should routinely prophylax patients with growth factor support because that's the reason why patients get into trouble. You know, the myalgias and arthralgias and neuropathy are bothersome, but they're not life-threatening. It's the neutropenia, particularly when you've radiated somebody, they've already had chemotherapy. And, you know, we allow them 6 weeks to recover from that treatment, but sometimes patients aren't fully recovered at that time.
When you look at those guidelines, one of the things that's sometimes difficult to figure out is which are the regimens that cause greater than 20%, which are the regimens that are 10 to 20%. Where would you put the common lung cancer regimens?
I think, obviously, if we're using more carboplatin than cisplatin, that causes much more myelosuppression. And so many of our regimens, particularly if we use an area under the curve of 6, so a lot of the commonly used regimens in combination with docetaxel at 75 milligrams per meter squared or paclitaxel, particularly if you're given 200 or 225 milligrams per meter squared, we do have a propensity to run into problems with grade 3 and 4 neutropenia. My personal practice when I treat patients in the metastatic setting is to use carboplatin. I generally use an area under the curve of 5 and not 6. And when I combine it with paclitaxel, I generally use a more conservative 175 milligram per meter squared dose. And in my experience over the last 5 years, I rarely have patients come in with neutropenic complications when I give the more moderate dosages, and I don't routinely support them with growth factor support. I think where this comes into play, where it's even more important, is now in the adjuvant setting, where we do push doses a little bit, and it's very important not to have dose delays and dose reductions and dose omissions. So if you want to keep your patients on schedule and maintain dose intensity for 4 cycles of adjuvant therapy, I do routinely use growth factor support in that setting.
What's the basis for your saying? I mean, we've always had this feeling in general in cancer medicine to try to get patients to receive full dose on time, but specifically in terms of adjuvant chemotherapy of lung cancer, what do we know about that?
There actually is very sparse data regarding this. I think it's just our intuition that if you want to treat micrometastatic disease, you need to do it without delay. Generally, you need to initiate it within 60 days of surgery so that cell repopulation can't take place. And you would think that you would be more effective if you were able to maintain dose. But what's interesting is with the positive adjuvant trials, we have found that it is difficult to maintain dose intensity. I'll just give you a quick example of that. In the recently reported ANITA trial, which was 800-patient trial from
Europe. It
was last year at ASCO. It took patients with stage 1, 2, and 3 disease. They all went to surgery, and then they were randomized to a control arm versus cisplatin plus vinorelbine. And at the end of the day, only 56% of the planned dose intensity of vinorelbine could be given, and only 75% of the planned dose intensity of cisplatin could be given. And that data is actually very similar to what we saw with cisplatin and vinorelbine in the NCI Canada study, for instance, and with other regimens as well. Despite the ability to deliver the dose intensity that we wish, and we would hope it would be somewhere in the 90% range, despite that, we were able to show significant survival differences on those studies. I just think that one would intuitively think if we are able to maintain the doses that perhaps we could even realize better gains.
Has there been an attempt to sort of look, maybe using a meta-analysis technique or whatever, whether there's a correlation with relapse and dose delivered?
That would be very interesting. The problem with that data would be somewhat compromised because you could make the case that there's a reason why somebody had, perhaps they had more comorbidities and they're destined to do worse for other reasons. Perhaps they had a complication, so their dose intensity was less. And I think that data would be difficult unless you were to prospectively do something.
I would think, particularly given your particular location in this world and also because of all the excitement about bevacizumab, that maybe the next thing you all are thinking about is bevacizumab. Is there an actual trial being considered right now?
Well, the Southwest Oncology Group is doing a 3-arm randomized phase 2 study looking at different ways of combining bevacizumab with their SWOG-9504 regimen. And so I believe one of the arms is giving it as consolidation therapy, one of the arms is giving it early in radiation, and one of the arms is giving it from day one of radiation therapy. So it's looking at what's the best way to incorporate bevacizumab. One other, I think, exciting drug in oncology of late has been sorafenib or Nexavar. And sorafenib, as you know, is just approved by the FDA to treat patients with renal cell cancer. And sorafenib hits many targets, including VEGF receptor 2. It's a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It is being tested in non-small cell lung cancer. In fact, a randomized phase 3 study is going to be conducted looking at chemotherapy with or without sorafenib. We are going to be looking at, in the Hoosier Oncology Group, how best to incorporate sorafenib with chemo radiation. And I believe we'll be the first to do that.
Getting back to the SWOG study, that's interesting. So you're saying they're using the 9504 regimen, i.e. docetaxel,
yes,
with bevacizumab. It's kind of interesting that they've retained their interest in docetaxel, although paclitaxel is the taxane used with the Bev trial.
That is correct. And my bias is that there's probably little difference. I can't conceive of why docetaxel would be inferior to paclitaxel.
Yeah, no, I was curious actually what your thoughts were in terms of whether you think there would be a difference between either one of them combined with bevacizumab in any setting.
I cannot think of why they would be different. Perhaps there are reasons I haven't thought of.
I haven't heard anybody say anything one way or the other, but it is interesting that they kind of kept that track and added in the Bev question. And that must have been pretty recent. When did they start doing that?
The trial is not open.
They're just talking about it.
It's a work in progress.
Cool. That's what I like about these interviews. You hear about these things, and then 2 years later, the trial actually gets done. And I was curious how you approach patients who aren't eligible for your study.
Well, if they're not eligible for our study, but they're still well and fit, and there's just one particular criteria that didn't allow them to be eligible, then I oftentimes do treat them with cisplatin BP16 and chest radiation therapy. I don't give them the consolidation therapy. I really haven't seen data that's better than that data.
Let's talk a little bit about adjuvant systemic therapy. You mentioned the ANITA trial. I don't know if there's anything new since then.
There are several trials that are closing. At ASCO, we will be getting an update on the CALGB trial, looking at stage 1B patients who got adjuvant carboplatin and paclitaxel. There is an update on that trial at ASCO this year. We will be getting a variety of trials from overseas. One trial looks at the role of preoperative versus postoperative chemotherapy with a surgery alone control arm, and a number of other randomized trials that will be coming in the next year or two. So I do think that there will be some more adjuvant data and some more neoadjuvant data as well. The U.S. intergroup is about to initiate their next randomized phase 3 study, and Dr. Heather Wakely at Stanford is the principal investigator of this. And this will be for patients who have undergone surgical resection. They'll be randomized to one of four different chemotherapy regimens with or without bevacizumab. And that will probably open the summer of 2006.
So, quote, dealer's choice of chemo?
Right. There will be a choice of giving cisplatin plus vinorelbine. There will be a Gemzar-containing arm. There will be a docetaxel-containing arm and a carbopaclitaxel-containing arm.
What do you anticipate in terms of accrual for that study and other similar studies? It's kind of disappointing when you look at the lack of numbers of adjuvant trials of lung compared to breast and colon.
It is very disappointing. And just to underscore the point you've just made, the largest randomized trial ever done in neoadjuvant therapy in lung cancer is 350 patients. That's the largest randomized trial ever done. The Southwest Oncology Group trial and the French trial are the two trials that have 350 patients. The next largest trial is a little over 100 patients. Well, so it is very disappointing.
It only kills 155,000 people a year in the United States. I mean, it's not like it's a major public health problem.
It is a major public health problem. And our major gains are going to be to prevent metastatic disease. The bevacizumab data that Dr. Sandler reported is very exciting, but it does only modestly prolong life for some patients in the metastatic setting. You're talking about a matter of a few short months for the majority of patients. The reason why that data is so exciting is that if you can prolong life in the metastatic setting with a new regimen, the goal would be that you can cure more patients in the adjuvant setting, and that ultimately is the goal. And just to take that one step further, the ultimate goal is to reduce the number of people who develop lung cancer in the first place. And we can reduce the incidence by 90% by reducing tobacco consumption worldwide. We're at a low in the United States. I just saw on the news the other day that tobacco use in the United States is as low today as it's been since 1951.
So is it under 20% yet?
It's in that range. Yeah. And of course, it had peaked in the 40s, in the 50s and 60s.
Right. Getting back to the adjuvant trials and the lack of numbers thereof, I kind of have hopes that maybe things are going to change. I see that the colon trial, for example, that the NSABP is doing, which is FOLFOX plus or minus bevacizumab, is accruing like crazy. It's a great study, obviously, but I don't know whether it's really right or not, but you know, I know oncologists are looking at it saying, well, you know, it looks pretty safe. You've got a bad disease. You've got a 50% chance of getting something that might help you that you can't get any other way. Do you think that's the way people are going to look at the lung cancer trials?
I think that's one of the incentives, and I agree with you that I expect the randomized adjuvant trial to accrue very rapidly within the United States. This whole idea about giving patients adjuvant chemotherapy is still a new concept to oncologists, and oncologists that have been practicing for a good period of time still have strong memories of the days in the 1970s, 1980s, and early 1990s when patients would get very sick with platinum-based therapy. Patients were still mostly dying within a year. Even patients with locally advanced disease would have difficulties with chemotherapy, and the majority of patients would still die within 2 years. And so it's still sort of a new concept. But now that we have seen compelling data, adjuvant therapy is considered standard. I think everybody is on the same page with this. I think surgeons are on the same page. The surgical meetings highlight the adjuvant trials. And so now surgeons will be more likely to refer patients for adjuvant therapy. And I certainly think that there is a great excitement with bevacizumab and the hope that it will cure more patients in the adjuvant setting.
It's been really interesting to track what people have been thinking over the last few years about how bevacizumab works. It's really fascinating. I talked to, you know, Lee Ellis and those guys and colon cancer and Kathy and breast cancer. But, you know, sort of globally looking back at this, like maybe a community-based oncologist would be looking at it. One of the things that comes across is this whole concept that maybe it's not just anti-angiogenic and this whole thing of normalizing the vasculature and delivering chemotherapy. How does that strike you?
Well, that probably is why you get higher response rates, at least initially. The thought is that at least initially you do have increased delivery of chemotherapy to cancer cells because you normalize the vasculature, and that it may very well be that after a period of months, as you give chronic therapy, you then reduce the overall microvasculature, and then it's more of what you traditionally think of as the anti-angiogenic effect.
A related factor, and you mentioned this before, is whether we can predict responsiveness, which has been pretty frustrating up to now. You were mentioning the isoforms. Anything that looks promising to you?
Unfortunately, so far what we've looked at has been disappointing. In Kathy's trial, as well as in Alan's lung cancer trial, the ECOG 4599 trial, a whole variety of things were looked at. And you would think intuitively, those patients with high VEGF level, something that simple, you would hope it would be something that simple, that those with high VEGF levels would have a disproportionate benefit with an anti-VEGF therapy. It turns out it had nothing to do with that. Those with high VEGF levels did no differently than those with low VEGF levels, and a whole number of other angiogenic markers as well. You know, it's difficult to know.
Getting back to adjuvant systemic therapy, I'm curious how you approach that right now in a non-protocol setting and what you consider sort of evidence-based options.
Well, I certainly think if you're a purist, there's absolutely no reason not to give the regimens that were given in the U.S. intergroup NCI Canada study, which was vinorelbine plus cisplatin, and certainly the large 800-patient ANITA trial, which also gave vinorelbine and cisplatin. So certainly I think it's perfectly appropriate to give that regimen. I also think it's not inappropriate to give etoposide plus cisplatin, since more than 50% of the patients on the international adjuvant lung trial receive that. And so now you're looking at numbers that are even greater than on the other trials. And so that's fine. I think in general, though, physicians think you should give the most effective drug. And that's the reason why I give cisplatin and not carboplatin. I do think that cisplatin is a little bit more effective. There's a meta-analysis in the metastatic setting, which does suggest it's more effective. There are some randomized trials that show that carboplatin and cisplatin are comparable in the metastatic setting. But there are also trials that show that cisplatin is a little bit better. And you really don't see the same study showing that carboplatin may be a little bit better. So if anything, they're similar, with cisplatin maybe being slightly better. In the palliative setting, it's an acceptable trade-off. In the curative setting, I think you should give your best drug. So along those lines, the question comes up, what is the best second drug to give with cisplatin? As I mentioned, I think it's very reasonable to give vinorelbine, very reasonable to give VP16. I give docetaxel. Let me explain why I give docetaxel. There are actually three randomized trials in lung cancer that show that docetaxel is a superior drug to vinorelbine. The first trial was a second-line trial that Dr. Fosello reported 7 years ago, comparing docetaxel with either ifosfamide or vinorelbine, and most of the patients on that control arm actually did get vinorelbine, and docetaxel had a superior 1-year survival compared to vinorelbine. The second trial was the TAX-326 trial, which Dr. Fosella also reported, which led to the registration of docetaxel first line. The control arm on that study was vinorelbine and cisplatin, and of course, docetaxel cisplatin was superior. And then the third trial was a study from Japan just reported at ASCO 2005, looking at an elderly group of patients treated first line docetaxel versus vinorelbine. And docetaxel was significantly superior to vinorelbine. So that's why I've chosen that as my adjuvant regimen. I think it is better than vinorelbine and cisplatin. And vinorelbine and cisplatin makes up the majority data in the adjuvant setting. So again, vinorelbine cisplatin, very reasonable. VP16 and cisplatin, very reasonable. But I think if you want to use what I would consider our most effective drugs, I would use docetaxel cisplatin.
What's the specific dose and schedule you use?
I use 75 milligrams per meter squared of docetaxel. Initially, I was combining that with 75 milligrams per meter squared of cisplatin, but I was finding that that was very difficult for my patients to tolerate. Lots of nausea and vomiting, lots of difficulties with other complications, and so I wasn't really able to get them through their 4 cycles. And so I have reduced the cisplatin dose to 60 milligrams per meter squared. The meta-analysis in the International Adjuvant Lung Trial suggested that if you can exceed a cumulative dose of 240 milligrams per meter squared of cisplatin, that you're giving the effective dose. So if you give 60 milligrams per meter squared times 4 doses, you're achieving that.
One other thing I wanted to ask you about is small cell in your presentation last year at ASCO. Can you talk about that trial?
Sure. So the Japanese Cooperative Oncology Group had reported a positive phase 3 study 4 years ago. They looked at the combination of irinotecan and cisplatin compared to a control arm of etoposide and cisplatin. And the etoposide and cisplatin arm performed as you would expect. The irinotecan arm was statistically superior. The study was meant to accrue about 225 patients, but the Data Safety Monitoring Committee stopped the study early, as they had planned based on what they had designed before the study had started. So only 150 patients were accrued to that study. We set out to either confirm or refute that data in largely a U.S. patient population. We used cisplatin and etoposide again as our control arm. We modified the dose and schedule of the irinotecan arm. 50% of the patients on the JCOG trial never got their day 15 irinotecan, and we were hoping to actually make a Q4-week regimen, a Q3-week regimen, and therefore you would actually intensify the dose intensity by modifying the regimen as we had. And then we sought to take advantage of the synergism between irinotecan and cisplatin, so we split the dose. And when you give cisplatin at its full dose and irinotecan at its full dose, you get quite a bit of nausea and vomiting. So the hope was by splitting the dose, it would be more tolerable. You would have fewer dose omissions. You'd be able to get more dose intensity in. So I was lucky enough to present that data at ASCO last year. It was about 330 patients. It was a 2-to-1 randomization. So about 220 patients actually got irinotecan plus cisplatin. And that represents 3 times the number of patients who got irinotecan on the JCOG trial. And unfortunately, we weren't able to replicate the data. The efficacy parameters were all the same. The median survival was about 9.5 months, 10 months on both arms. The one-year survival was the same on both arms. The differences between the regimens were in terms of toxicities. The etoposide arm does cause more neutropenia and more neutropenic infection. The irinotecan arm causes more diarrhea and mucositis and dehydration. So it is a trade-off of side effects, and you have to think about your individual patient. You have to determine, you know, which side effect profile you should look at in your individual patient. The Southwest Oncology Group is replicating the JCOG regimen. Both arms of the SWOG study are exactly the same as both arms of the JCOG study. It's a much larger trial than the JCOG trial. It's a larger trial than our trial. It'll be over 500 patients. I understand that accrual is quite good and that they are nearing completion of that study. And if it's a matter of us changing the dose and schedule of the irinotecan arm and that was the reason why it was not superior, then the Southwest Oncology Group study should show us that.
What do you think it's going to show?
I don't think it's going to show any difference.
Why do you think the Japanese study was positive?
It may very well be that that regimen is better in a Japanese patient population. The Southwest Oncology Group and the Japanese groups actually have done an interesting cooperative analysis. They designed phase 3 metastatic studies at the same time, and they agreed to use a common arm of paclitaxel and carboplatin, pretty much the same dose and schedule, same eligibility criteria, same patient populations. And, you know, of course, they reported their trials independently in their patients, but then they wanted to compare the efficacy and toxicity in the U.S. patient population versus the Japanese patient population. And they found astonishing results that the same carboplatin and paclitaxel regimen caused more hematologic toxicity in the Japanese patient population, but its efficacy was much better as well. The median survival time was 4 months longer in Japan than it was in the U.S. It's also been recently realized that there may be biologic differences within the tumors of those patients in different parts of the world. For instance, we know that in Japan and other parts of Asia, EGFR mutations are more common than in Europe and in the United States. And lastly, there may be pharmacogenomic differences. We know that there are different levels of UGT1A1 enzyme, which is the obviously important metabolizing enzyme of irinotecan. And there have been data to demonstrate different levels of this in different patient populations and how that correlates with changes in toxicity and efficacy. Could be a number of things. The other possibility is in the Japanese Cooperative Oncology Group trial, it was only 77 patients per arm. And when you look at small studies, very small differences in patient characteristics can have a profound difference. And just to give you an example of this, 17 patients on the etoposide arm had brain mets compared to only 9 or 10 on the irinotecan arm. It doesn't sound like a lot, but if it's only 77 patients, small differences like that could make a difference. We noted that there were differences on our study. I'll just give you one example of that. More than 50% of patients on our study had liver metastases, and the number in the Japanese study was much lower. I think it was on the order of 20%.